Let's get underway. I'm Ian Lachlan. I'm both chairing this and participating. And I'm sort of here with my risk management practice hat on, but a little bit more as I'll explain in a minute. We have Jennifer Lang here, who is the Chief Actuary Wealth Management at the Commonwealth Bank. She's got 20 years' experience in financial services, including working for life insurance companies as an asset manager and as a financial services consultant, is now at the Commonwealth Bank. She's written a number of papers for the Institute over the years, including the choice of risk discount rates for the valuation of life insurance companies and on asset liability modelling for life and general insurers. So that's Jennifer, and we'll hear from her very shortly. We also have Andrew Husko. Andrew's been working in the insurance industry for more than 25 years in a wide range of roles in both consulting and corporate environments. He's been Chief Actuary of Allianz Australia for 10 years and added the role of Chief Risk Officer 4 years ago. Wearing both hats, he's in the unusual position of having a good view of the overlap and differences between the risk management and actuarial roles. And lastly, we have Stuart Bingham. Now, Stuart has been at APRA for just over 2 years, and he currently works in the Supervisory Support Division as the head of life insurance risk. He manages a team of actuarial and insurance risk specialists focusing on life insurance issues. Prior to joining APRA, he worked at Westpac BT for 18 years. And his last role there was head of finance, insurance, managing a team of actuarial and accounting professionals covering both life and general insurance. In addition, Stuart was appointed actuary for Westpac Life Insurance Services Limited and BT Life Limited and was responsible for capital management of BT Financial Group. Now, I've also got a bio for myself here, but I'm going to skip that. The only relevant bit is that I'm on the board of AMP Life and I chair its audit committee. So I'm going to give you some comments from that perspective. So I'll start, and then I'll hand over in turn to my colleagues, and then we'll open it up to discussion. Now, I need you to use your imagination. I first of all want you to imagine that you're not an actuary. Okay, so take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. You are not an actuary. But you've recently been appointed as a non-executive director to a life insurance board. And by the way, we've got some general insurance people here, I think. Can anybody from general insurance? Yeah, a number of general insurers. Good. So we've invited a number of general insurers along because this is relevant to both life and general insurance. But we'll focus on life insurance. You've been appointed as a non-executive director of a life insurance company. You're very excited about this. You're very conscious, though, of your governance obligations and that standards have generally been rising. That is, governance standards have generally been rising. There's a lot of regulatory emphasis placed on risk management responsibilities of boards, so you're aware of overseas developments such as Basel II and Sarbanes-Oxley, and more locally, ASX Principle 7, and you understand some APRA regulations as well. So you've been doing your homework. And you've realised that the business is really quite complex and it's exposed to a host of different risks. So you've got various financial risks, market risks, operational risks, and so on. You've been given a pack of information as part of your development, and it includes some relevant regulations. In particular, it includes LPS 220. And there's a GPS equivalent to this. First of all, you find out that the board is ultimately responsible for the risk management framework. Okay, so that makes you sit up and take notice. It doesn't say the management's responsible, it actually says the board is responsible. So you wonder what this risk management framework is, so you delve a little bit deeper. And it says the risk management framework is the totality of systems, structures, policies, processes, and people within the life company that identify, assess, mitigate, monitor all internal and external sources of risk that could have a material impact on the life company's operations, right? So this risk management framework is this big. It then goes on to say that at a minimum, the risk management framework needs to include various things, a risk management statement, various policies, controls, procedures. It includes the business plan. It includes clearly defined managerial responsibilities and various other bits and pieces. You delve a little bit further, and it tells you that there are certain reviews of risk of the risk management framework that are mandatory. And one in particular catches your eye, and it says, the appointed actuary must include an assessment of the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework as part of the financial condition report. Okay? So that great big thing is going to be reviewed by an actuary as to its suitability and adequacy. Now, you've heard a bit about these actuaries, and you know that they play a really important role. So you breathe a sigh of relief because you know this person is sitting there looking after this stuff for you. You arrange an appointment with the appointed actuary to take you through the financial condition report, and in particular, you're very interested in this sign-off of the risk management framework. And so you decide to ask a few questions about it. Now, I'm going to stop at that point and just pose a question. Just what would you be expecting at this stage that the appointed actuary has done to justify signing off on the risk management framework? Okay, carry that thought. We're now going to hear from Stuart, and as mentioned earlier, Stuart's from APRA, and then we'll hear from the two appointed actuaries, and then we'll open it for discussion. Stuart, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Ian. What I want to do today is discuss APRA's perspective on how appointed actuaries have gone about responding to the requirement to assess the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework. First of all, I'll discuss why APRA put this requirement in.
Can I just interrupt? We've got our slide slightly out of order. Just stay there. We did ask a number of appointed actuaries a couple of questions. So let me just walk through those and then we'll get to your slides. It'll work a little bit easier. So the first question, as you can see, and this is to appointed actuaries, how comfortable are you in completing the risk management section of the FCR? And you can see the answer dominates reasonably comfortable. Okay? And there aren't too many saying very comfortable. That's question number one. So question number two. Which statement best describes how you feel about the risk management section of the FCR that you prepare? It's mostly a compliance exercise, about a third of the people. It's value-adding for the board and for the entity, and that's only 60%. So there's a big chunk, as you can see, regarding it pretty much as a compliance exercise, something that's got to be done by necessity. How would you describe the attitude of each entity to risk management? About a quarter are saying it just meets the regulatory requirements. About a third have embraced the risk management framework, and the others are somewhere in between. And would you participate in a more comprehensive interview? The answer is no, and I don't know why. So. And there are some questions there about general insurance and life insurance. So you can see most of them came from general insurers. So now, just better make sure that your slides are actually here, Stuart.
No, I don't have slides.
You don't have slides. Well, that makes sense. your name's on the screen.
Okay. So first of all, I want to discuss why APRA put this requirement in. Then I'll discuss what APRA's expectation is of appointed actuaries, APRA's view of how appointed actuaries have approached this task, and then finally, what areas there are that we see for improvement. During this talk, I'll mainly refer to the life insurance requirements, but the general insurance requirements are very similar. So my comments around APRA's expectations do equally apply to both the life and general insurance industry. So let's recap what the requirement is. So the requirement is that the appointed actuary must include an assessment of the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework as part of the financial condition report. So that seems pretty clear. So why did APRA ask appointed actuaries to do this? After all, as Ian has pointed out, LPS 220 already requires an independent review of the risk management framework, apart from the requirement of the appointed actuary. So why did we ask the appointed actuary to do this as well? So the answer is quite simple. APRA places a great deal of reliance on the appointed actuary. We see the appointed actuary as crucial to the sound management of life and general insurers. And as you are no doubt aware, the appointed actuary is required to perform a number of statutory roles. So I'll just list a few. So in the life insurance context, that includes providing product advice, advice on reinsurance arrangements, advice on distributions of retained profits and capital, and of course, the annual financial condition report. And the annual financial condition report is probably the most important document APRA receives every year from a life insurer and a general insurer. So we expect that the appointed actuary will understand the key risks faced by insurers and will also have a holistic view of the risks faced by the company. The Prudential Standard talks about the material risks that must be included in the risk management strategy. They are asset and liability management risk, operational risk, life insurance risk, including risks arising out of reinsurance arrangements, and strategic and tactical risks that arise out of the life company's business plan. It seems pretty clear to me that the appointed actuary is ideally placed to understand these risks. And perhaps with the exception of operational risk, the appointed actuary has probably the best understanding in the company of those other risks mentioned. So as I said before, from APRA's perspective, the appointed actuary is absolutely ideally placed to understand these risks and how they should be managed. I'd also like to point out that this requirement actually represents a great vote of confidence from APRA in the actuarial profession and in the role played by the appointed actuary, and further highlights the reliance that APRA places on the appointed actuary to ensure the sound management of insurance companies. So let's now look at what APRA expects. The requirement is for an assessment. So quite simply, APRA expects a discussion. We want to know why the appointed actuary thinks the risk management framework is suitable and adequate, and I'm assuming there they do. And we want the assessment to consider the key risks of the business, how they're assessed, how they're monitored, how they're reported, how they're mitigated. We also expect the discussion to include areas that the actuary thinks need to be improved in the risk management framework and what areas of weakness there are in the risk management framework. As noticed in the practice guide, APRA doesn't expect a full review or audit. Also, we don't expect a simple statement saying, I have reviewed the risk management framework and find it suitable and adequate. And unfortunately, we have seen examples of that. Generally, APRA is very pleased with the approach taken by the appointed actuaries, and it is clear to us that the requirement has been taken very seriously. In fact, I think it's fair to say that the approach the appointed actuaries have taken has actually exceeded APRA's expectations. Most discussions are clear, they're comprehensive, and they discuss the key risks of the business. However, like all things, there are rooms for improvement. Sometimes the assessments represent a list of what the risk management function does. We would like to see greater emphasis on why the appointed actuary thinks the risk management framework is suitable and adequate. We would like to see a greater linkage between the key risks for the business and how the risk management framework addresses those risks. As the requirement has now been in place for a few years, we are now starting to be concerned about a practice of just simply copying and pasting the previous year's comments on the risk management framework. As a result, We think that there should be some emphasis on what has changed and why the change has occurred. And as I've said before, some discussion around areas of weakness and areas of improvement that are either planned or that the appointed actuary thinks should take place. Thanks. I think I'm handing over to Jennifer now.
Thanks, Stuart. I've been asked to speak about the life insurance experience of assessing the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework in the FCR. To do that, what I've looked at is both what we do in our own company, but I've talked to a few appointed actuaries and the LIWMPC, but this is very much my own view of the totality of it, and I wouldn't want to necessarily be thought to be speaking on behalf of anybody else. So first, a bit of background. We've been required to prepare an FCR since 1945 in the life insurance side. And by its nature, a financial condition report has generally dealt with many or even most of the financial risks facing life insurance companies. But I guess in the last 10 to 15 years, the focus on risk management in that document has probably increased. First, with the introduction of risk-based capital, effectively solvency and capital adequacy back in 1996, but then also with APRA requesting increased focus on target surplus and capital management has also naturally extended the focus into the FCR on risk management. So the FCR generally has covered capital management strategy, risks to strategy, asset liability management and risks, and the management insurance products and therefore the insurance risks associated with those. But it hasn't always covered control frameworks, compliance risks, operational risks. So the simultaneous introduction of the requirement for life insurers to have a risk management strategy and then the appointed actuary to assess the risk management framework has meant that actuaries have got more involved in the holistic risk management side for companies in a general sense. So appointed actuaries and their teams have often been involved in understanding what the big risks are facing companies and working with companies how to address them as part of the development of the risk management strategy. So in assessing the risk management framework, actuaries have generally worked pretty closely with the risk management team and also very closely with the operationally independent reviewer of the risk management framework, in my experience, using tools such as looking at the risk register for completeness and appropriate mitigations, reviewing risk frameworks against APRA guidance notes around risk management, reviewing policies, tolerances, control frameworks, both from a general understanding of the key risks and specifically in conjunction with the risk managers responsible for them. So in practice, the FCR itself as a document has changed by very much, pretty much everyone I've talked to around this has centralised what existed in the FCR on risk management into a single risk management place and specifically focusing on the big risks facing companies. So I guess from my perspective, the value that appointed actuaries can add in this process is to improve the company's focus on the holistic enterprise-wide risk management framework. The risk management focus of many companies and actuaries prior to LPS 220 was probably more piecemeal than it is now, more single-issue focused depending on the particular issue that the company or the appointed actuary or both were interested in. And the introduction of both the risk management strategy and the commentary on the risk management framework has meant that appointed actuaries and companies generally have focused more on the enterprise-wide nature of it. So with that introduction, everybody involved in the risk management process has had to think more about the overall risk profile of the company and whether the focus of the business and its risk management is appropriate to the relativities of the risks. I doubt if we've got it all right yet. It's difficult to get the right focus on the big top-level strategic risks, but at the same time making sure that the little small risks get the attention that they deserve before they become the large risks. From my own personal perspective, the work that we've done has generally meant that I've learned about the risks that aren't naturally part of an actuary's training, particularly the operational risk and compliance risks, but also it's meant that I've thought much more about the enterprise-wide nature of the risk, so the interactions between the way in which the companies work. So that's a life insurance perspective. Now I'm handing over to Andrew to talk about general insurance.
Thank you, Jennifer. The disadvantage of going last, of course, is that many of the points, or a number of the points, that I was actually going to cover off, of course, are covered off by these people. And it's actually heartening, in a sense, to see that there are obviously is a lot of commonality between the general insurance requirements or general insurance practices and, of course, the life insurance practices. Just a bit of background. I mean, on the general insurance side, the general insurance industry as a whole, when it comes to risk management, the requirements or the statutory requirements came in earlier, I think, than the life insurance area. It was about 2002, 2003. So the general insurers actually had a bit of a head start. Where we didn't have a head start was the requirements when it came down to preparing financial condition report. The first financial condition reports prepared for general insurance were around the 2006 mark. So that, I suppose, an advantage and disadvantage is that the general insurance actuaries at least had a bit of a chance to start from scratch, I suppose, and think of things from where it was originally. Think of things without actually having to look in more detail at what was in existence. I suppose my main background, of course, is the fact that I work for Allianz. I am now the Chief Risk Officer. I wasn't at the time I had to write the first financial condition report, but I must admit, being in the role of the Chief Risk Officer, I've probably learned a hell of a lot more about the whole risk management framework of my organisation. One of the key things, I suppose, that gives me guidance as to whether I'm happy with the risk management framework is there are various standards. There's obviously lots of textbooks out there. There's the ISO 31000, which came out late last year, which sets out a standard for a risk management approach. And to be able to sit down and tick that off from a chief risk officer point of view is something that gives me comfort that the organisation does have a reasonably robust risk management framework. In terms of risk management, what I've learnt is that there's probably two key elements. I mean, Jennifer touched on it when she was talking. What there is, I suppose, I think about it in terms of qualitative and quantitative, or the operational risks and the non-operational risks. As most of the previous speakers have said, the key thing is we as actuaries, or as the chief actuary of an organisation, have a really good view of the quantitative type risks of the organisation. I don't think there are too many other people in such an organisation who will actually have the breadth of experience and knowledge about how these financial risks work. On the qualitative side, or the operational risk side, as Jennifer quite rightly pointed out, we don't tend to have as much exposure to that. What I have found, particularly in my role as CRO, is that most of it is actually common sense. Most of it, if you've actually been, being a chief actuary, you should have had exposure to a wide range of parts of the business already. You will have actually seen what good and bad practices are. The other thing is, one of the big things which I tend to find is that it's actually the culture of the organisation. And if you're in an internal actuary, it's obviously a lot easier. You do get a feel for what the culture of the organisation is. If you're an external actuary, it's a bit more difficult. But by actually having a look at how they enunciate or how they set out their ways of managing risk in their risk management strategy, you'll actually find that it's actually it's a very good way of understanding whether they have a strong risk culture or not. As an appointed actuary doing my annual review, I must admit there's an element that I actually rely on, and that is the external reviews or the independent reviews. There's the internal audit and the external auditors. Both have an interest in making sure there's appropriate risk management structures in place. That means I don't go down and do the audit approach. I mean, as Stuart said, APRA are not expecting an audit of the risk management strategy, but I think you need to understand the key elements of it. In terms of the risk management strategy, from my experience also, is the business is the one that owns the risk. I mean, I have a risk management team, non-actuarial people reporting into me, but if this risk management team were the ones actually sitting there day-to-day controlling the risk, the business wouldn't be controlling the risk, the business wouldn't be interested. And what I do tend to find is you need to have ownership by the business of the various risks. Some of the other things to cover that I suppose fit in and actually come probably in the financial condition report in the other areas, obviously the extent of any capital modelling in terms of how the business actually runs its capital management. Capital management is obviously a key link to the running of a general insurer and a life insurer. A couple of things that haven't been mentioned, stress testing. I mean, most organisations, if they have a solid risk management process, will actually have stress testing. And this is it's a fairly simple tool, but it's a fairly blunt tool, but it's actually a very useful tool to give an idea as to what, particularly on the financial side, may actually cause potential solvency issues. One which is slightly linked to stress testing, or very similar, is what I call extreme event. And this is where you sit there, it's almost you sit there in the afternoon after on a Friday afternoon, have a couple of beers and think, what can go wrong? What are those way out things that can go wrong? And what happens if a meteorite hits somewhere? What happens if the markets completely collapse a particular market? What happens if the government can't pay back its debts? Things like that. I suppose it all comes part of the holistic nature of enterprise risk management. I mean, it's actually looking across the risks, along the risks across the whole organisation. Jennifer mentioned the risk register. Simply by going down the risk register and identifying all those risks or seeing the risks that are actually listed there will give you a good idea as to whether they've at least identified all the risks, how well they're being managed. Some of that will actually come through probably via either the internal review actually happening, internal audit review actually happening. Some of it will be picked up in external audit review. Some of it in your just day-to-day involvement in the business will actually be picking up any issues in the risks themselves. How would I include it in the FCR? My approach is fairly simple. Its approach is a summary of what's actually happening. As Stuart said, commenting on changes, so commenting on the change of the risk management framework in the previous year. I actually do list all the risks in the risk register and then point out those risks in the risk register that I've covered elsewhere in my FCR, capital management, the insurance risks. And then there you're left with the unusual, the odd ones, or the operational risks, and then a brief discussion as to how you think those risks are being managed from how you see it. As the appointed actuary. I suppose that's probably the main thing. The takeout, and particularly on Stuart's comment, it's up to you to actually assess the risk management framework. The risk management framework is something that is, I think, fairly straightforward to assess. You should be able to see whether there's a big hole somewhere, a material hole anyway, and be able to rely to some degree on how the business actually is run. So I think that's about all I want to say. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andrew, Jennifer and Stuart. Shall we open it up to questions? So you can ask questions of the panel. Yeah, we have. Can you say your name for the record, please, too?
Dave Morris. Actually, Jennifer asked me to say a few words from the perspective of someone who actually is over on the end of all this stuff that ends up in the financial condition report as a director of a company. And these are purely personal observations and also certainly no reflection on what we actually get to see. But I suppose when this requirement first came in, I was extremely sceptical. Principally, I think just the point that's previously been made, that I wasn't sure that actuaries necessarily had the skill set to comment on particularly operational and compliance. I mean, most of the other stuff probably fell into the FCR in one way or another. A few years down the track, I suppose I'd moved to maybe. I'm entirely sceptical. The problem I have is that as a director, you actually get lots of commentaries on the risk management framework and statement. You get sort of an independent review, which extent voluntary audit that you get the external actuary, the external auditors commenting on it. You get within the FCR, and you also, in an Arctic, for instance, you've got a separate sort of risk management team, and you get separate reports. Now, fortunately, they all seem to agree at this stage. But I guess the difficulty comes is when they start to disagree. And where, you know, it just seems to me that you get too much in two different places, and the need to put it together maybe, and that's where I actually find the FCR probably is of most use, is that it does tend to pull all of that stuff together in one place, and is a pretty good summary usually of what's gone on during the year. So overall, I think it is appropriate and does seem to add some value, but
thank you for that ringing endorsement.
Mark.
David, it is good that we actually all agree. I'm Mark Baxter here from CBA. I'm the Chief Risk Officer of Wealth Management. And my comments do not reflect what we do at the bank, I've just been reflecting on the standards, and I have been for quite some time, and I sometimes really wonder whether there's a sort of a perversity in sort of actuaries wanting to move into risk management and being CROs and having the obligations on and appointed actuary. And probably with more a sort of a question for Andrew, because I struggle with the fact that the appointed actuary is actually asked to comment on the risk management framework, at where they are the CRO, they're actually commenting on their own framework, and that sort of, I wonder how that conflict is actually managed. And as a CRO, I see myself as actually, probably more within the financial conglomerate. Yes, the board of a life insurer, general insurer, are my stakeholders, but I actually also act for the ultimate shareholder, and I'm accountable to the ultimate shareholder. And within a life company, the AA has to actually consider the policyholder's best interests and so forth. So again, there's sort of an inherent conflict in what you actually do. I do expect there's probably, in setting up a risk management function that ultimately goes to the shareholder or reports to the shareholder, you probably expect from time to time that there's a healthy tension between the AA and the Chief Risk Officer, and I can't kind of imagine them being one and the same person. So they're just sort of thoughts. I think they're the panel that you want to comment on that.
Andrew, do you want to?
I can
never make a comment.
Is this on?
I suppose it may be a function of the slight difference between general insurance and life insurance. For example, I don't actually have any control or control on pricing. So, for example, from an appointed actuary position in general insurer, I'm required to be independent. Risk management functions are required to be independent. My input to pricing is at the moment, largely limited, obviously apart from pointing out when something's going to be done wrongly, is really limited to try to dole out the capital and help to dole out the capital. In fact, to actually provide input to the business to decide how they want to dole out the capital. In terms of conflict, there is a potential conflict there. It is very difficult. I suppose I satisfy myself by the simple fact that are required to be independent on both of them. The interest of the policyholders from the appointed actuary of the general insurance is probably not as strong as it is in life insurance. So it may be that it's a general insurance thing. It's a bit easier to do. Probably that's as much as I can comment on at the moment.
Thanks, Andrew. Are there any life insurance actuaries who are both CRO and appointed actuary in the audience? Yes. Okay. Do you want to make a comment, Mike? Because that sounds interesting.
Look, there's no doubt there is the potential for
conflict. I do agree that you are in a position where you are commenting in the FCR on the framework that you have built and are responsible for. That conflict is certainly there. I mean, actually, we spent a bit of time thinking through how we would manage that conflict. There are a number of processes that we used. Disclosure was one. Discussing with internal audits another, and there are a whole bunch of different ways in which we try and manage that conflict, but there is no doubt it does exist. I think the nature of financial services in Australia, I think you've got a relatively small group of people here who operate in the large companies in Australia. There are only a limited number of people who are prepared to put their hands to fill these roles. So I think we're used to conflicts, I'm used to conflicts, and I think by and large they manage pretty well. Fortunately, it's a conflict I no longer have.
John.
My question to the John Graham. My question to the panel is around the general area of quantification of this, and it's in three parts. Firstly, I guess how crucial is quantification of risk in the context of the overall risk management framework? Secondly, how sophisticated is the approach to quantification of risk? Do you think in your respective how sophisticated should we be as actuaries in terms of the approach to quantification of risk? And thirdly, what should we be doing in particular about the really soft areas such as reputational or compliance risk in regard to quantification?
Yeah, sorry. One of our microphones has died. So.
I might start, but I'll happily hand over to others. I guess my view is that the right way to quantify risk generally is an economic capital style approach. Maybe I view economic capital as the price of risk. But I think you've got to be quite careful that you don't get swept up in, well, I've got a number, so therefore that's the end of it, because most economic capital frameworks do look at the very extreme tail of the distribution. I don't think you find any actuary who thinks they really know exactly what the number is at the tail of distribution. So it's very important to overlay that with a kind of common sense almost look at things. And particularly when you get down the strategic and reputational line, I'm not sure that having a major strategic risk or a major reputational risk, putting a price on it, necessarily changes your actions. The whole point of economic capital one is just to make sure that you've got something that you might want to think about. How much money they should make in return for something. But a strategic risk, probably it's either an on-off issue in many cases, so putting a price on it doesn't necessarily change things. So again, that's having a risk management framework that forces you to think about the major effects that could have a big impact on the business rather than quantification. It's definitely more to it than just quantification.
I think it's worth noting that all risks can be scaled according to their impact, and so sometimes it's quantification, but if you take reputation for example, you can have a scale of impact. You know, to be very simplistic, you know, you don't want your company on the front page of the AFR with a negative comment, so that's a very adverse outcome. You can't quantify it, but you can use it as a measure, and so there are others like that. Likewise, compliance. You know, you can set tolerances for breaches of compliance that maybe you can't quantify. Other questions? Sorry, Andrew. Go ahead.
Some comments. Quantification, while very difficult, I think is something that particularly a financial services organisation you need to do, simply because at the end of the day, you're holding capital. You need to know how much capital you hold. Whether the quantification is as simple as, well, we've been given these guidelines called solvency requirements for APRA, and that's, we're going to run off that to the point of actually getting in and actually creating a model, a detailed model with lots and lots of parameters. Probably depends on your attitudes to how important that capital is, how material you are, or how large you are, because obviously quantification location, the smaller you are, is it worth the resources to actually try to spend those numbers more? The softer ones, yes, they're always difficult to do. But as with any model with limited data, which many actuaries are used to doing, is you've got to start with some assumptions somewhere and actually work through the process of testing them.
Other questions about complying with LPS 220, Mark?
Probably more a comment. If I can talk about qualification, I actually agree entirely with Kent. But around managing risk, we've been actually going through a process of developing at a group wide level and within life management our risk appetite statements, where we do actually deal with both the quantitative and qualitative risks, and we actually talk about the boundaries that we have. We actually talk about things that we just won't touch. And I think that's a really fundamental part of that risk management, actually giving a clear articulation of risk appetite. And part of the value in actually developing the risk appetite for entities within the group and the group as a whole is that you actually start the discussion about how you actually manage reputation, how you manage your strategic risk, how you manage your compliance risk, and how you manage your operational risks. And it's important that they actually get discussed in real time.
I agree with that, but just hang on to the microphone. Would you like to comment on how difficult or otherwise you have found that process of trying to get clear risk appetites articulated and then translated into tolerances and so on?
It's a very difficult process, yep. And particularly around the qualitative risks, because how do you actually set up tolerances, and you really need to actually have really good a lot of it is actually around discussion and making sure that you get the culture right also, and actually sort of having defined limits at times. And in terms of the use of words is sometimes really, really tricky. Zero tolerance to a certain risk implies that you just will not accept it. And for example, fraud's happen, breaches of asset requirements happen, but you're actually trying to avoid them. Get some sort of agreement around sort of what words to use. Because if you say zero tolerance, you imply you're actually going to devote an enormous number of resources, yep, to that risk. So the short answer is it is actually very, very difficult. It's ongoing. And we've gone through a process just recently of establishing our risk appetite statements, but I know we're actually going to be evolving them over the next year as we actually learn
the best way to actually find them. Yep. I'll just make the comment that I think an actuary commenting on the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework has got to pick up that sort of stuff as well, because it is absolutely fundamental. So, Mike.
This is probably a question for you, Ian. So, Stuart commented on how our APRA and Chown found a great deal of trust and place a lot of confidence in the actuarial community in setting up LPS 220 and requiring the actuary to comment on the risk management framework. And I think there are certainly opportunities for us, as Jennifer said, to get involved in the holistic enterprise-wide view of risk across the industry, to, for us as actuaries, to broaden our skill set in both risk management roles but also in traditional roles as well. So do you think that actuaries in general will sort of grasp that opportunity?
At an earlier session today, I sort of broadly broke our membership up into three groups. Those that really understand enterprise risk management, believe in its value, and believe that actuaries have got a very important role to play in it, and so on. Those sitting in the middle that are sort of, I've got a watching eye on it and are not too sure, and those that think it's just the latest management fad. I think across the board, though, we've got a long way to go as a profession before we really understand what this is all about, what the opportunities are that it presents, putting aside the regulatory requirements for a minute, understanding the opportunities that it presents and how we can actually make the most of those opportunities. I think the regulator or the regulations have given us a free kick, and we are nuts if we don't take the most of that free kick. Stuart.
Yes, Stuart Roger. Firstly, a quick comment on that question. I'm here from a health perspective, and I do some work in the Singapore legislative environment where stress tests annually are mandatory. And when you've looked at the stress test to achieve, you realise quite quickly there's an awful lot of things that capital is not the answer to, and you need to be thinking about what will I do that doesn't chew up capital. And that's just the codified ones from a stress test, let alone the broader ones. My question, and I realise halfway through your answer, this might be similar to the last question, but what is it about an actuary's career and experience and training that equips him or her to actually do this?
Well, let me repeat it.
I just want to yep. expand on that a bit too. Andrew mentioned the culture, for example.
Yep.
So there's an implication there that somewhere in their career, this person has picked up an understanding of culture, how it works, how you create it, and how you use it. So that's an example of where in their career did the actuary learn how to do this.
Okay, let me try and tackle the last point. Let me try and tackle the last point first. Being an expert in enterprise risk management doesn't mean that you are an expert in every aspect of it, or that you are an expert in every individual type of risk. So if somebody is, say, the chief risk officer, they absolutely need to understand the importance of the risk culture in the organisation and what it is and how it's operating and what the implications are and so on. It doesn't mean that they need to be, you know, an expert in the latest in human resource thinking, but they sure as hell need to understand it. It doesn't mean that they need to be an expert in occupational health and safety. They need to know that that's important, that it's controlled, somebody's responsible for it, there's proper reporting of it, and so on. So we need to be careful that you don't assume that if you're the chief risk officer, you are in charge of every risk in the business. You are not. The business is in charge of the risks. You need to understand how it all hangs together. So I'll make that point. The second point is that, and I'm repeating something I said at an earlier session today, I think actuaries are, when you're talking about risk management in financial services, an actuary with a traditional set of skills is in a great starting place. But that's what it is. It's a starting place. And in my view, it's a better starting place than most other people with different backgrounds. But it's nowhere near enough. So you've got to build on it with real enterprise risk management skills and understanding, and ideally a broader business understanding. If you just come to the table with a very technical perspective, you deserve to be treated accordingly. Okay, but if you have ambitions to be treated seriously by management and boards, you need to understand how they think, what's important to them, and so on, and respond accordingly. That is a hell of a big challenge for us as a profession generalising. Okay. But the opportunity is there, and through appropriate training, CIRA won't help you address those points that I just mentioned. It'll set you down the path. But there are other ways of developing those skills, and one of the most important things is an awareness of what's actually required. We did have a little survey done by a guy called Rob Kay recently, which was fascinating, and if you go back to Actuary Australia in December, I think there's an article on his findings. And Melinda, he's about to run a course, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've got him running a one-day course. Yeah. How much is this one?
We don't know yet. We're doing a one-day course that Dr. Rob Kay is running for us, and it's just sort of all getting organised now. But it is for actuaries, and it's about how to deal with CFOs and senior management and boards and what they think and what they want, and how we might approach risk or communicating with these people one way. But they all want an answer, so they don't want you to say, well, I'll go away and run a model and come back in 2 weeks. They want your gut-feel answer on the spot. So it's that sort of thing. What are they expecting? How do we communicate differently to better meet senior management expectations?
Yeah. So can I take you back to the imagination? You're sitting there across the table from the appointed actuary. If the appointed actuary, you know, talks to you in very narrow terms, understands what the liabilities are and thinks there's something happening about operational risk management over there, and they're not really in charge of that, somebody else is in charge of it, and so on. If that sort of picture is put to this board member, then, again, they'll be treated accordingly as narrow technicians. Okay. If, on the other hand, they demonstrate a comprehensive understanding of how the whole thing works and satisfy the needs of this person, give them comfort, that person will come back to them every single time. And I just think that is the overwhelming opportunity presented to us, because boards and senior management desperately need somebody they can go to who really understands how it all hangs together. That's the opportunity. Andrew.
I suppose just a comment is, I mean, at the end of the day, not every accountant is good enough to be a CFO. I mean, there will be very, very good statutory accountants, so great statutory accountants, but you will put them in the CFO role. Similarly, potentially those who are managing accountants that aren't necessarily going to be the CFO. But those who have the ability, and this is going to be a challenge of institutions, those that have the ability get the exposure and a chance to actually learn those skills or understand what's required. Some of it's just standard business sense. I think it comes down to the individuals. It's like, I suppose, yes, I hold the hat of CRO and Chief Actuary, but if it wasn't me as a person here, would the Chief Actuary naturally be the Chief Risk Officer of ALS Australia? Don't know. It depends on who the person is. It's probably true in any organisation, but particularly at senior management level, some people actually end up with a whole grab bag of things because they're good at doing the grab bag of things. As Ian said, some of them are very, very focused technicians, and that's their strength, and that's where they'll stay.
I think I'll just add to that the, I don't know any chief actuary who writes the FCR themselves, writes everything in the room themselves. The skill of a good appointed actuary is to really understand where their expertise is and where the team's expertise is and where the expertise of the rest of the business is and harness that. What they are is looking at the overview and work and trying to understand as much as they can about the business and writing the appropriate thing in an opinion. So it's very much about understanding what you do know and what you don't know and giving the expertise when necessary.
Yep. David?
David Birdsall. Just to answer Stuart's question, actuaries are trained in analysis of information in a mathematical and hence a logical way, and we also examine complex judgment. That's where the training is. And the challenge for us as a profession is to use those skills in a wider area. But as far as I know, we're the only profession that does that, and that's not global. We only have some areas actually do that.
Yeah. Okay, Stuart Lowery again answering his own question. I agree with everything that's been said there. I wanted to hear it said, and the bit that I agree with most was at some stage in their career, they've stepped out from the pure traditional technical role and seen part of the world through the eyes of some other role. So that Ian used the word commercial, Andrew used the word kind of multi-disciplined or talented, but you're good at. Jennifer talked about understanding how the business fits together as a whole. And all the training that Dave's mentioned, coupled with practical experience, I think the two are essential.
Thanks very much. Can I just make one further comment? And it repeats a point I made this morning. There's a tendency to think of being an expert in risk management. Sorry, let me re-express the point. there's a tendency to think in terms of the risk management function when we're talking about being an expert in ERM. ERM is both an area of practice, but it's also an area of expertise that spans all of the different practice areas. And I strongly believe that even somebody doing a very traditional role deep within an actuarial department within a life company, if they have a good understanding of ERM, they'll be better able to do their job because they understand how it all fits together that much better. Can we just have one quick show of hands? Do you think that the Risk Management Practice Committee, working with a couple of the other practice committees, should develop some sort of guidelines for what an actuary should be signing off on, what the actuary should be doing to sign off on under these requirements? So if you think some guidelines would be helpful, could you put your hand up? Okay, that's good, thank you. Well, for the record, who says no? No one. Good, just wanted to make sure it added up. I'd just like to thank Tim Gorst over here as well and a couple of his colleagues who pulled this session together and developed the idea and so on. It's one of the subcommittees that we have. So thanks very much, Tim. And we're finished. Thanks very much.